Hi, I'm Jennifer Osborne. This is the Conversations of Hope podcast, stories of hope as told by those who live them. Today's conversation is with Beth Nowak. After participating in a TEDx talk, she was approached about sharing her story with a group of high school students. That began her journey of self-compassion about the effects of a chaotic upbringing and what had led her to the point of addictions in adulthood. She discovered her story didn't begin with her, but with her parents. Eventually, that journey led her to mercy, compassion, and forgiveness, with a deep need for honesty and vulnerability with those around her. At one point in the conversation, she alludes to a senior trip and a trauma that occurred. Due to the length of the interview, it was cut out and held for a potential future release. Thank you. So I'm really glad to be here talking to you today, and really excited to be able to share a little bit about your story. And how long have we known each other now? 2 years?
At least, yeah. Yeah, because I spoke at the women's conference in 2016. And that was in October. So yeah, a year and a half, almost 2 years.
I know some of your story, but people watching this have no idea about any of your story. When you were really considering telling it for the first time, and there's lots of material, you've had lots of adversity, a lot of things that had happened. What were the things that you really felt led to share? So if somebody said, gosh, tell me a little bit about who you are, and you're presenting it, how did you pick, I guess, is what I'm kind of gathering, trying to gather.
In any situation, I can never just tell one story. I feel like I have to tell the story behind the story. And so as she asked me to prepare for that, I was like, how deep do you want me to go? Because the audience was teenagers, in order to be relevant for them, I needed to share kind of my teenage years story, which was, experimenting with drugs and alcohol, being promiscuous, just looking for acceptance and control. And so there were eating disorders and all of these things kind of bound up in those years. But in order for that to make sense and to put it into context, I had to kind of go back a little bit and share my childhood and what put me in the position to be open to those behaviors as a young person. So, what was interesting is through the process of preparing for that presentation, what I realized was that my story didn't even start in my childhood. It started with the family, my parents' story, and what put them in a position to parent the way that they were parenting. And I just kind of, it turned into this realization of the layers of the onion, right? It was like, I can talk about my teenage years, but at peel that back a little bit, and there's some things that happened in my childhood that helped me get there. But you peel back a few more layers and you realize that there are things that happened in my parents' lives that
they're all interconnected.
All interconnected. And so I think part of the biggest message I was trying to convey to the students was that, it wasn't so much that I'd been selfish, but my whole life I'd kind of lived in this victim mentality of, it's my parents' fault, or it's, all pointing my finger at all these different things. When in reality, when I took a step back and looked at it from this different perspective and realized that my parents had gone through a lot that changed the way that they behaved towards me, all of a sudden I realized that they were victims too. And I was able to all of a sudden have compassion for them in a different way. And then came forgiveness to them, and then eliminating the anger or resentment or bitterness really, was so freeing. I mean, it was great.
So let's talk about a little bit about your childhood, talking about that. So, you went through just some crazy stuff in your childhood. Tell me a little bit about it.
So my birth father went to prison when I was about two. My mom divorced him, which she had grown up Catholic. And so that didn't go over very well. But she remarried when I was four. And I had an older sister who was 4 years older than I was. So my sister would have been eight. And she had a chronic medical condition that required a lot of care from my mother and diverted her attention away a lot. So I kind of felt on an island a little bit. But then shortly after my mom married my stepdad, 10 days later, my stepdad's brother committed suicide. And within 3 months, my mom's mom died. And 3 months later, my stepdad's mom died. So, you know, this was all before I was, you know, 5 years old. And so there was just a lot of grieving going on. And so when my parents weren't trying to take care of their own emotional health, they were trying to take care of my sister's physical health. And so it really just left me on my own. But then shortly after, I think it was around 8, I was in the 3rd grade, my mom had been a manager in a bank and went through 2 armed robberies within a week. In fact, Wow. She was writing a police report for the first robbery when they were robbed again. And the second time they were robbed was much more violent than the first. The women were locked in the safe. And this was in the 80s. It wasn't a diagnosis at the time, but basically she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which affected her in a lot of different ways. Just extreme fear in public and home. So she was heavily medicated from that. And so Wow. At that point, I kind of took over all the female responsibilities in the home. And my stepdad traveled quite a bit for work. So, I mean, by the age of 8, I was doing all of the things the mother of the house would be, and, you know, had a sister who was still, by that point, her medical condition had been pretty well under control. But to be the mother to your mother at the age of 8 is a big responsibility. So by the time I ended up in high school, you know, it was just, well, I should back up just a little bit. My birth father was released from prison right around middle school and wanted then to have visitation in custody of, or, you know, fight for some visitation of my sister and I. And he was not a pleasant man. And so that created a lot of, again, fear in my mom and discord between just everyone. And it led to my stepdad adopting my sister and I. So here I was going into middle school, just a total wreck. And then on top of that, like because of the adoption, my name changed. I mean, it was like identity crisis times 10 as a young person. And, you know, middle school's hard.
How old were you when it really manifested the first time you started recognizing the eating disorder part of it?
About 14.
14. When were you bulimic or anorexic? Or
I was a little bit of everything. I mean, yeah. I would eat to soothe, and then I would purge, and then I would go through periods of time where I wouldn't eat anything at all. I mean, I was 5, you know, at that point. I'm 5'10 now, so I was probably like 5'8, 5'9, still growing. And I was under 100 pounds. I mean, I was very, very small. And my family was concerned, but, you know, that was a different time. People weren't necessarily making the connection between that emotional stress could be manifesting itself physically. And if it was, people weren't necessarily talking about it. They were just saying, you know, you should eat more. You don't look healthy.
So coming out of middle school into high school, that's a big shift anyway, going from, you know, middle school is typically your transition into, you're growing up, you're going, getting ready to get into high school. You get into high school and it's just like so much bigger. So how did you transition into that? And
well, I think pretty much my whole life, like I kept thinking, oh, when I go from elementary school to middle school, a change of scenery will change my mindset. This is all I need to do is just change my environment and then everything will be fine.
Yeah.
So I had that same mentality going from middle school into high school, and very quickly that I realized that wasn't the case, and the bottom kind of fell out, and I jumped from one group of friends to another. You know, the first group of friends, I did very well in school without trying very hard. And so that was in a lot of ways, kind of my escape from everything was to do well in school. It appeased my parents. I felt like I was accomplishing something. So I was I was kind of that perfectionist pleaser person.
What were you doing to self-comfort during that time? Because I know there were a lot of things that we've talked about that got expressed during that point in time in high school. I know you were cutting.
Yeah, I was cutting.
You were drinking.
I was cutting. I was drinking. I was smoking. I was smoking weed. I was having sex. I was just everything, controlling food. If you look at a textbook on mental health and the evolution and onset of age when things happen, I mean, I fit the bill for all of it, and I just progressed through all of it.
At this point, we began to talk about her addictions as an adult and being able to recognize our attempts at unhealthy self-comfort.
You potentially don't even recognize the issues until it's like, where am I finding my comfort? Where do I turn to first when life gets too overwhelming? And, you know, it can be anything. You know, it can be food, alcohol, whatever. But in your case,
well, and
that was the first thing you recognized as of late.
That's just it, is that, you know, I have friends who are on the same journey as far as stopping drinking. And their husbands in support have also stopped drinking or, like, rid the house of any alcohol or... But I mean, alcohol's not necessarily my problem. This, like, God-sized hole is my problem in whatever it is that I'm trying to fill myself with. So, once I stopped drinking, then I kind of had more of a compulsion for more of a sweet tooth. My body was craving the sugars. And so, you can't live in a vacuum. I can't rid my house of alcohol and sugar. And I mean,
right.
You can't do that. So it's not a how do I get everyone around me to kind of change their habits to be more conducive to my sobriety. It's how can I be in a setting and not be controlled by all of those thoughts and temptations and desires and wants. It just comes down to discipline and faith and you don't get that unless you have a relationship with God.
How did it force you to be more real? Like, mm-hmm. You got the, like you call it, the God-sized hole that everybody has, that they, you know, can be tempted to fill it with a lot of different stuff, like you pointed out.
Yeah.
How did that force you into the realness of, okay, this is where I am?
Yeah, I think just... verbalizing it. And one of the things I actually say in my team presentation is, when we share our struggles verbally, they lose their power over us. So I actually wanted to find as many people, and I would a woman had just moved in up the street, and the first meeting time we met, it was like, hey, how's it going? I think I probably had a beer in my hand. And then the second time I met her, I was like, hey, I quit drinking. I think I have a problem with it. I just want to let you know, So it was that, just being open and honest. And I mean, I think I've come to the realization at this point in my life, if some people are not receptive of that kind of honesty, and if they're not, if they don't like the first thing I say, they're sure as hell not going to like the rest of what I have to say, because I can no longer not be honest. The day that I, speaking of that whole situation on senior trip and everything, I still have a hard time talking about it, but the day I actually verbalized it and started processing it in real healthy ways was the day that that last weight had kind of been lifted and was like, oh my gosh. This freedom of not having a secret anymore, not having anything else I haven't said out loud, was just so freeing. And so I don't know how you go backwards after finding that freedom. I mean, you can't. So it's been life changing for sure. And so all the work Brene Brown's doing with vulnerability, and just even my own personal little experiments, I almost... not so much for the shock value. I mean, I'm not trying to put people off, but at the same time, I kind of gauge who's potential to be in my circle based off of how well they can handle just real honest statements. I mean, I don't have to be vulgar or obscene or anything, but I can say the truth and you either receive it or you don't. But that then is an indication to me on whether or not we'd be a good fit to be friends. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And
which is why we hit it off so well.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I think, a lot of what you're saying really resonates with me. Like secrets are power, and not necessarily good power. It can hamstring you. It can stop you from growing. It can just send you to some really dark spots. And also not being honest and allowing yourself to be vulnerable can bring, well, not being honest can put you in bondage, but being vulnerable will bring you freedom. And that just seems very contrary to the things you believe about yourself when you've been through trauma, because then it's secrets protect me and not being vulnerable protects me. And it creates just a weird bondage for you. So yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I want to be completely real.
I think one of the biggest problems being a trauma survivor is that you have that victim mentality. And as a victim, you feel like you are owed for every wrong that's ever been done to you. And what's interesting about that is that God says in the Bible very clearly, you will be paid back. But as a victim, you hold on to that and you're expecting payment in a way that you imagine it to be. And the reality is you get payment in God's form, which is way better than what we could ever expect for ourselves. But it's that victim mentality, and which is selfish in nature and doesn't really allow us to look at the people who have maybe wronged us and realize like, wow, they were wronged too, which is why they act like that. I mean, so it's just a domino effect. It's a constant, struggles with my stepdad and things. Like, he didn't receive love as a child, so he never knew how to give love. You can't give what you never received. And having compassion and understanding for that and just being able to still have a healthy relationship, knowing that is what makes it possible. Not knowing that, not understanding that, not having compassion for it creates a lot more discord than just taking a deep breath and trying to realize like he's hurt too.
Yeah. Well, and I look at that as kind of a vulnerability as well. If you can look at the people that have hurt you and not put them in just this box of they were bad and they treated me bad, and you look at, okay, well, what was going on there? And you learn to have compassion for where they are and mercy, as God tells us to have mercy. And that's a game changer, I think. Doesn't right anything that they did that was wrong. You gain a level of understanding, and it takes you to a different place of healing. And that's hard sometimes, especially when you've had really big things perpetuated against you. But
when it makes forgiveness possible, I mean, until you have that level of understanding, forgiveness is impossible. I mean, there's no way to do that. But when they say forgiveness is really a gift to the person who's giving it, right. Not to the person who's receiving it.
You've been listening to the Conversations of Hope podcast. Stories of hope as told by those who live them. Music by Lauren Dusky. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2022 by Parable Road.